Imagine the sun would rise once in a lifetime. No one would be sitting here now. We would all be watching what's going on. So it happens every day. The Baal Shem Tov says that's a miracle. It's just a frequent miracle. But the world essentially is a miracle happening. If it would be something from something, that would not be the case. Hashem creates it, and that's it. There's a world functioning. But the world is something from nothing, so its whole existence is to be attributed solely to its creator, to its originator, to its fashioner. Fashioner really applies only to Yesh Miyesh, to its creator. Hence it needs a continuous, hence it has to always exist. There has to be a perpetual divine energy which creates it at every moment as it did in the beginning, and if for one moment that would cease to exist, the world would essentially become nothing and naught. In other words, it would return to its natural state. I stand corrected, not its natural state. It would return to the natural state where there's no its, where the world does not exist. Yeah? Exactly. It says in Chassidus, very good point. Teva comes from the words tubu b'yamsuf, which means submerged, drowned, concealed. When something is submerged in the water, it's concealed. Because the same thing that is happening at the time of Anes is happening at the time of Teva. It's just the frequency conceals the nature of what's going on. It conceals the nature of nature. Did Hashem pre-program miracles from the beginning of time? It says, about certain miracles, it says clearly that He pre-programmed them. But in light of the above, it's obvious that there's no need for pre-programming miracles. Because He's constantly reprogramming nature, even nature. Yes? Every day is a new program. Every moment is a new program. The world on its own, again, has no inherent validity and justification, legitimacy. Creation of the world is not a change of form. It's an action against the very nature of reality, which is zero or nothing. The zero state is the fundamental state. So everything that exists is an emergence from, you might say, a primordial emptiness. And emptiness is not the real word here. Huh? Nothing. So the whole reality and existence of the world is to be attributed only, solely, and exclusively to the Creator. So it needs, it requires a continuous energy to sustain it. So you'll say, even if Hashem removes His energy, it should continue to exist. Why should it continue to exist? On its own, it should continue to exist. On its own, it never existed. Even before it didn't exist. So you want now it should exist. Elamai, you want it should exist because Hashem is bringing it into existence. He's not bringing it into existence anymore, so it doesn't exist. I want to apply this concept, I want to articulate this concept for a moment in yeshivish terms. The difference of Yesh Miyesh and Yesh Miayin. In Yesh Miyesh, in something from something, the Gavra is a din in the Heftza. In Yesh Miayin, in something from nothing, the Heftza is a din in the Gavra. When you create something from something, there is the object, the Gavra, the man creating it, and the Heftza being created. You are subordinate. You are serving the object. You took one object and you fashioned it into another object. That might have taken a lot of toil, work, required sophistication, skillful, artistic talents, and so forth. But ultimately, you are working with a Heftza. It's about the object. It's not about you. You articulated, you revealed something that was inherently there, at least potentially. And you revealed, you brought out the potential. So even if the Gavra is gone, the Heftza continues to exist. Yesh Miyayin is converse. The chefetz is a din in the gavra. Even when it's there, it's not about the chefetz, it's not about the object, it's about the gavra that brought the object into reality. As in the metaphor of the daydreamer. In the daydream, the chefetz is happening, but it's all about the gavra. It's all a detail, an aspect, an energy, a projection of the person. The moment the person is there, the chefetz is not there. Why? Because the chefetz was never there outside of the person. This is the point that the Rebbe explains in Shara Yichud V'Emunah. And this is the first and primary explanation of what Achdus Hashem means according to the Baal Shem Tov. The issue we began raising last week, we discussed last week and continued here with Alter Rebbe begins discussing here. This is the first explanation. What does it mean Hashem is one? Not that there's one God and there's no other God. That by no means defies the discipline of something from something. There can be a God and no other gods, but the whole world is something from something. In fact, you might say, since Avraham Avinu came and introduced the beliefs of Yiddishkeit into his life and experienced an intimate relationship with Hashem, the Jews have been in conflict with the rest of the world. In every decade and century, they were in conflict with someone else. Until Mashiach comes, that's the case. What was the nature of this conflict? Why can Jews not get along with anyone? So not getting into the spiritual, psychological, mystical issues, which we addressed a little in Perikut Chesitas, in one word you could say that there's one discipline that puts the Jew apart, one philosophical approach that puts the Jew apart from every other philosophy and discipline in the world. Something from nothing versus something from something. And this includes secular scientists as well as religious believers. Something from nothing in the true sense of the word versus something from something. Something from something means that the world ultimately can be traced back, can be identified somewhere. Somewhere I exist. So after my somethingness comes out, I exist. God also exists, but I exist. Achdus Hashem. The true meaning of Achdus Hashem is not that there's one God and there's also a world. How does the Alter Rebbe say? Atahu atchalei nivraelam, atahu mishin nivraelam. The Zelber who? The same oneness that characterized Hashem pre-creation characterizes in post-creation. The same hu levada yihu that existed pre-creation exists after creation. You'll say there is a world, there is me, there is you, there is him, there is rain, there is a continent, there are continents, there's a universe, and so on and so forth. So how can you say hu levada yihu yachid meyuchad? Say there's one God, there's one creator. How can you say there's one reality? The world has no reality whatsoever, save the energy, the creative energy, the Dvar Hashem, which is constantly sustaining it. This does not mean that the world is not a real being. It means that the being of the world is not real. This does not mean that the world is an illusion, a dream, or a fantasy. It's not real. Its existence is not real. Its existence is even more real, in a sense. It means that to attribute the term reality to the world, to attribute the term yeshus, being, to the world, that's unreal. That's where the illusion begins. The world exists, b'reishis baruch lekim hashamayim v'haaretz. But to attribute reality to that existence, reality still can be attributed exclusively to God, to Hashem. Yachidu miyuchad kaidim shenivra olam. All that large population that has been contrived as a result of creation does not compromise his aloneness, his yachid u'meyuchad dynamic, even one iota. So the world from the Hasidic perspective is not Maya or an illusion in the Oriental sense, which is coming as a result of an optical illusion and an errant perception. Rather, it's reality as an autonomous, independent being, divorced from the all-pervading reality of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that is an illusion. This is the preface, the foundation, the axiomatic prefacing words of the Alter Rebbe to discuss Achdus Hashem as he will discuss it here. When he says that the Hishavus originally and the continuous existence Einay Ela Dvar Hashem, it's not a metaphor. It's not a Melitzedek terminology, a nice terminology he uses. Einay Ela Dvar Hashem. It's all about his creative energy because it's Yesh Me'ayin. It's something from nothing, and something from nothing is exclusively about the Gavra. And the Heftze never compromises the Achdus of the Gavra. Obviously, this doctrine, which Chassidus brought into the fore, emphasized a whole new type of relationship between Creator and creation, between the Jew and Hashem. The rationalists, certain modern rationalists, are still fond of defining it as the radical immanence of Hasidism. But the Chassidim, this actually transformed life and every aspect of life into a melody. This doctrine, to be sure, doesn't, as one might think, repress human creativity, individuality, liberty, independence. On the contrary, the previous Rebbe once said, "The Alter Rebbe had bewiesen, wie klein ein Mensch ist und wie groß er kann werden." The Alter Rebbe demonstrated how small the human being is, how great he can become. Because in order to know how great you can become, you have to know how small you are on your own. What this doctrine essentially is saying is, that the individuality of a human being is godly.
And this is the true path of Chassidus towards self-actualization. Man has no true eye outside of the divine eye. As difficult as it is to visualize, and it's very difficult to visualize, the exclusive definition of the existence of the entire cosmos, and myself included, and yourself included, is its inner divinity and spirituality. Our existence has no definition outside of the fact that Hashem brings it into being. So self-actualization is synonymous with self-transcendence. The true definition of the self is godliness. Getting in touch with me, with my own true identity, means getting in touch with the godliness that's in me. So to find myself, I need to lose myself. I need to surrender the false perception of a self. The Gemara puts it, the Gemara Masechta Tamid, the Daflamid Beis Amud Aleph, Zog the Gemara, that Alexander Megdon, Alexander the Great, asked 10 things from Ziknei HaNegev, from the elders of the Negev, of the south. And one of the 10 questions that Alexander presented to them was, Ma Yavit Inish V'Yichya? What should a man do in order to live? And what did they respond? Their answer was, Amru Le Yomis Esatzmai. What should a man do in order to live? He should die. If you want to live, what should you do? You should die. Let go of the perception that you're detached from Hashem. Let go of the notion that you're not spiritual, that you're not godly, that you're not holy. Now you can truly begin to live. To surrender that perception of a self, that I exist, that there's an I to my existence, that in a way is death. And that's the prerequisite to life. One of the greatest disciples of the Maggid, of the great Maggid of Mizrich, the teacher of the Alter Rebbe, was the holy Reb Aaron of Karlin. And his father-in-law was a very fierce opponent of Chassidus and of Chassidim. And once, after Reb Aaron returned from a long stay in Mizrich, his father-in-law asks Reb Aaron, he says, tell me, what did you learn in Mizrich that I don't know? Reb Aaron responded, nothing, garnished. His father-in-law was very pleased with Reb Aaron's reply. And he says, now that you have finally discovered the truth, that you learned there nothing, let go of all this craziness and become a normal Jew again. His father-in-law was pleading. Reb Aaron responded and he said, I'm sorry, you misunderstood my words. In Mizrich I have learned that I'm nothing. In Mizrich hab ich gelernt, dass ich bin garnished. What did Reb Aaron mean? Did the men who came out of the study hall of Mizrich suffer from a low self-esteem? Did they all have this inherent sense of worthlessness? Did the Alter Rebbe, for example, think of himself as valueless and meaningless? What about Reb Melech of Lezhensk, the Holy Baditshever, Reb Nachum of Chernobyl, Reb Mendel of Vitebsk, Reb Shmelka of Niklasberg, etc., etc.? For people with such wounded self-esteems, they seem to have accomplished quite powerful things. What they learned in Mizrich was that the only true definition of the I is the divine I. My I is nothing but a conduit for the godly I.
I want to share with you something. I once gave a lecture in California. And I encountered a Jew there, a very spiritual man. And after hearing my lecture, he approached me, and these were the words he told me. I'll never forget them. He said, to the extent that you'll be self-conscious, that will be the extent to which you won't get it. To the extent that you'll be not self-conscious, that will be the extent to which you get it. That's the essence of Chassidus, and everything else is commentary. A writer once wrote a story about a novel. He authored a novel about a novel. And the main thrust of the story goes something like this. There's a character in a novel who decides to maximize his opportunities in life. So he spends a lifetime building his ego, his power, his fame, his career, his bank account, and so forth. One night, he's sitting in a bar, enjoying a good drink, and really enjoying life. And suddenly, somebody walks into the bar. And when the character in the novel hears the footsteps of this man, he begins trembling. And when the man actually enters, and the character drinking beholds his presence, he's totally nullified. Who walked in? Exactly. The author. The author of the novel. when the author steps into the bar to visit his character, the character's perception of the world is changed forever. Suddenly he realizes that he has no existence save the strokes of the pen of the author. Every moment of his life requires a new stroke of the author's pen. So all these years he was holding on to an image of self that never existed. And this is the story of our lives as well, and our relationship with the author of existence, with Hashem. So the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, in the final chapter, sixth chapter of Pirkei Avos, in Mishnah Vav, the sixth Mishnah, Kal ha'omer davar b'shem emrei mevi gula l'olam. He who says something in the name of its speaker, of its original author, brings redemption to the world. And there are various interpretations to this Mishnah, and in Chassidus this Mishnah is interpreted as follows. He who says something in the name of its speaker, which means he who identifies in every single thing its speaker, the divine orator who is speaking it into being, he brings healing and redemption to the world. Because a world divorced from its godliness is a dysfunctional universe. A human being detached from the speaker within him remains discontent. He remains unfulfilled because his life is disconnected from its own truth, from its true identity, godliness. So in summation, according to the Alter Rebbe, and what the Alter Rebbe is teaching us here in chapter 20 of Tanya, it's wrong to make a statement, Hashem is, God is. God is this, God is that. Isness is God. The is of everything is Hashem. Hashem is the term we use to describe the is of everything. It's not God is this, God is that. The isness of everything is Hashem. So when the Torah says, obey Hashem's commandments, obey Hashem's wishes, and you'll be blessed, that is the Torah's way of saying, define yourself based on your true self and you'll find fulfillment. When the Torah tells us, disobey Hashem's wishes and you'll be cursed, as the Torah says numerous times, it's another way of saying, if you behave as if you are who you are truly not, it will never work. Because you're fighting your own reality. You're not being true to your own truth, to yourself. Hashem is the reality of reality. We exist within reality. We exist within Hashem. Now this doesn't mean, I should just emphasize this parenthetically, this doesn't mean that there's no God outside of man. It means that there's no man outside of God. The Medrash puts it, the Medrash says, why is Hashem called Makim? In Torah, one of the terms used to describe Hashem is Makim. Hu Mekaymei Shalaylam Ve'enayilam Mekaymei. Hashem is the space of the world, but the world does not constitute His space. Now, for a Yid who connects to this truth, and it's difficult to integrate this truth, everything changes, life changes. For example, all the elements of worry, fear, etc., anxiety, they're reduced to zero. Inner joy, serenity, there's a certain peacefulness that fills his life. That's A. B, also very important, such a Yid never takes his ego too seriously. And C, his behavior is moral and ethical par excellence. He's honest, he's genuine, he's real. He never feels that he has to manipulate a situation to get his way. He knows that everything he has or does not have is being created and given to him at that very moment by Hashem. So those are three, just to mention, there are many more implications, but these are three extraordinary foundational implications of this doctrine. It removes worry in life, fear, insecurity, anxiety. It gives you another perspective on how to deal with the ego, and it changes the way you deal with morality and ethics, among many other implications. And now here, we come to the final point. With this I want to conclude. The metaphors given above have an essential problem, and therefore they're incomplete. And that's why I said before that in the Hasidic discourses themselves, another metaphor is brought. It's a more abstract metaphor, as I mentioned, but its truth, it's more meticulous. And that's what I want to share with you, the second metaphor that's discussed in Hasidic discourses to explain this doctrine of something from nothing versus something from something. Basically, we discussed the metaphor of the novel, I just said. That metaphor, I once saw in an article. I don't know who wrote the article. Someone sent it to me. But I thought it was an interesting parable. The parable of the daydream to describe the process of the universal creation, I read in a lovely little book. It's called Something from Nothing. And it was authored by a Yid named Rabbi Yaakov Brower. And he employs this metaphor. In fact, in Tanya in chapter 48, the Alter Rebbe employs this metaphor of a daydream to describe another concept, to describe the concept of Seviv Kolamun, which we'll discuss then. But in this book, Something from Nothing, he employs it to describe the concept and the process of universal creation. So you mentioned before, correctly, that in the metaphor of the daydream, there's no real ayin, because the daydream is culled from previous pre-existing data. And that's 100% true, and that makes the analogy incomplete, but that doesn't bother me so much. Because on the contrary, you could say, if even in that case, where it's not totally something from nothing, you still have to recreate it every moment, and it has no reality outside of the imagination, certainly here. But there's another problem that you didn't mention. In both of these examples, whether the daydream or the novel, besides other elements in which they do not suit the discussion at hand, the real problem is, I believe, that in both of those cases, there's no real yesh me'ayin. There's no real yesh. There's no real something that is created from nothing. Because the stuff from which the characters in my dream are made is my imagination. So one can easily perhaps say that in these analogies, there was no emergence of a second reality. There was no creation of a yesh, of a something in the true sense of the term. Although we employ the term creation. I'll say that I created a character in my daydream, in my imagination. But I can say, one can easily say, that essentially these characters are an expression of the imagination itself. It's the imagination expressing itself in various patterns. So certainly there's no reality outside of the imagination. The very stuff of every character in the daydream is the imagination. My imagination is the character, is the time, is the place, is the audience, is everything. The same is true about the novel. In our case, we're dealing with a yesh. Hashem created a world. How does the Torah put it in the first pasuk? I mentioned, Bereishis bara Elokim es hashamayim v'sa'aretz. Hashem created a heaven and an earth. He created a physical world as well that you can touch with your eye fans and touch with your fingers. The koyach, the divine creative speech, created something. There's another example that I once heard to convey this truth, this doctrine of cosmic unity, of Hashem's unity in the world. If I'm standing in front of a mirror, my reality, my image is being reflected in the mirror. If I will leave, so will my image leave, depart from the mirror. Why? Will anybody ask why? Why doesn't it remain there in the mirror?
Now you're laughing, but what's the answer? Why not? The answer is because the definition of my image in the mirror is that it's reflecting me. It doesn't have a reality outside of the fact that it's reflecting me. That doesn't mean that it's an illusion. It doesn't mean that it's a fantasy. In fact, you can take a photograph of my image in the mirror and you will know exactly how I look. You can take a picture of it. It's real. I am really being reflected in the mirror. So there's a true reality. This human being is being reflected in this mirror. His reality is somehow present there. An image of it, a reflection of it is present there. But everybody understands that the definition of this reality is that his identity and his reality is being expressed there. It doesn't have an identity detached from him. But again, this is not a complete metaphor. Because there's no creation, there's no yesh meyayin. The mirror is just a continuum of the eye. So certainly there's nothing outside of the eye. The eye didn't create anything. The eye is just being reflected in the mirror. So these are all good examples to convey certain truths, certain elements of this doctrine. But in Chassidus itself, in the literature of Chabad Chassidus itself, another metaphor is brought. It's discussed at length in the Chassidic discourses of the Rebbe Rashab, of the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Shalom Ber, particularly in his discourses of the year Tofresh Mem Gimel 1883. And briefly, this is what he says. If I take a ball and I throw it upwards, it will remain in the air only as long as my energy is imbued in the ball, is propelling it to fly in the air, to move in the air. The moment that my creative, my power is exhausted, it will fall. Why? So the answer is because the ball inherently is subjected to the laws of gravity, and the ball under these circumstances belongs on the ground. So my power superimposed itself on the properties of the ball itself and compelled it to fly in the air. So when my power is exhausted and utilized, it falls down. Why? Why shouldn't it stay up there? So that's not a question. Why should it stay up there? Inherently, it doesn't belong there. It was all about my power. It was exclusively my power that propelled it and compelled it to be up there. A ball in our world, in our hemisphere, is subjected to the laws of gravity. Those are its properties. Now, the fact that the ball is flying is somewhat of a metaphor and a parable, an analogy for something from nothing. Because there was a reality created here that is in contradiction with the properties of the ball, at least its properties in this environment. How did it happen? Because a human being has a power to create new realities. So even though this reality is in contradiction, is contrary, is in opposition to the inherent properties of the ball in this environment, nonetheless the human being has the power to impose his energy upon the ball and to create a new reality, namely that the ball should fly. So is somebody going to come along and say, hey, did you see what happened today? We discovered a flying ball. Even though the ball was flying, nobody's going to say we discovered a ball that flies. The ball didn't fly. Even though it flew, that phenomenon is to be attributed exclusively to my power, not to the ball itself. So Chassidus says the same is true about the world. Don't come along and say there is a world. There is Hashem and there is a world. Just like the ball, no one is going to say, wow, today we discovered a ball that flies. It's true that the ball is flying in the air. That's true. But nobody's going to say, here we have a ball that flies. There is a power that's constantly creating and propelling it and affecting this reality. And the same is true in our case. Of course, Hashem brought a world into being. The world exists. But you cannot attribute to this existence the term reality. The term reality can be attributed exclusively to the divine energy that's bringing it into existence. Now again, the analogy is incomplete. Why? Because in this analogy, the stone wasn't created something from nothing. That's true. In our case, the whole cosmos was created something from nothing. But as far as the detail, as the element of its flying is concerned, That's the closest example to something from nothing. My power created a reality of a flying ball, but that reality has no existence outside of the energy that is causing it to happen at every moment. So in other words, reality has not changed as a result of the creation of the universe. Just as prior to creation, reality was defined as Hashem, now to post-creation, this has not changed. Reality remains the same. Hashem. In the words of the Alter Rebbe, V'chol ma'aminim shehu levadayhu k'may shahaya k'idim shenivra elam amish. All believe that He's one alone post-creation, just as He was one alone prior to creation. This is the beginning of chapter 20. Now, in the continuation of chapter 20, this was all an introduction. Now, in the Hemshech, in the continuation of this chapter, the Alter Rebbe takes this to the next level. Till here, he discussed the relationship of the world to the divine creative energy bringing it into existence. Now, the Alter Rebbe will reflect upon the nature of the relationship between the divine creative energy, or the godly word that creates the universes, and Hashem Himself, the source of this creative energy. The Alter Rebbe will now explore what you might call the Hasidic theory of relativity, examining the value of the divine speech creating the universe from the point of view of the creatures of the world being created by the speech versus the point of view of the speaker, the originator of this word, Hashem. Now, the conclusions of this spiritual theory of relativity have very far-reaching implications. And if we are to take them seriously, and it's not easy, they must change our lives forever, metamorphosizing our entire conception of reality, redefining our perspective on the nature and function of Torah and mitzvahs, which the Alter Rebbe will explain in the upcoming chapters in Tanya. So in chapters 20 through 22, he explains the fundamental principles of this truth. In chapters 23 through 25, its implications on human behavior. He then takes a break for 9 chapters to discuss how one can become a happier person. And in the middle of this discussion on the pursuit of happiness, in chapter 33, the Alter Rebbe returns to our present theme of cosmic unity, continuing with it throughout chapter 40. And I might add that if you thought that this week's discussion was hard enough to integrate, and it is hard to integrate because it's contrary to our natural perception of life, now we'll be exposed to a truth that requires continuous meditation, self-refinement, self-discipline to get in touch with. But it served as a fundamental principle in the teachings of the Alter Rebbe and in the Chabad school of thought, and it stood at the core of his own spiritual yearnings and aspirations. A Jew once came to the Baal Shem Tov and he says, Rebbe, your Hasidim, your followers are insane, they're meshuggah, they're abnormal. Why do you say that? Asks the Baal Shem Tov. The Jew says, I always see they're happy. They always seem to be dancing. If not dancing, in actuality, they always seem ready to begin dancing. And that's insanity. And the Baal Shem Tov says, you know, I want to tell you a story. There was once a musician who lost his job in a city, and he wandered to another city, and he was desperately needed to make an income. So as that happens many a time till today, the musician went out to the street and began playing his instrument. And he was a genius. He was a brilliant musician. So slowly people began gathering around him, listening to this extraordinary music. And even though it was the middle of the marketplace, in the middle of the street, and people were coming to work and going from work, and it was quite busy, but nobody could resist the sound of his music. It was just so soul-stirring. It was so powerful. It was so spiritual. It was so beautiful and sweet. People were just flocking to it. And it became more beautiful, and the momentum began to build, and excitement continued to accelerate, till people started to dance, and they put their arms around each other, and they began dancing, and circles of people were found in this marketplace dancing to this extraordinary music. Tens of people, and then hundreds of people were dancing ecstatically. In the middle of the dance, a deaf man passed by. And he sees in the middle of the marketplace, in the middle of a busy street, hundreds of what seemed like normal, ordinary people are standing, holding each other's arms and dancing ecstatically. And he thought to himself, wow, the entire city went insane. I'm the only one who remained normal. Alazana Meshugigwan, and everybody went crazy. And of course, the problem was, the tragedy was that he was deaf. He couldn't hear the music. So he just saw people moving around and jumping around and moving their arms and legs in what seemed to him absurd, being absurd in this environment, and he could not hear the melody that was propelling it. So the Baal Shem Tov says, you know, there is a melody vibrating through the universe at every single moment. And for somebody who hears this melody, to dance is the most natural thing in the world. Have a good day and a wonderful week.
This is a very weak level of reality to begin with.
No, it's not.
I mean,
on its own, it's a weak level of reality. It's not a weak level. It's a more powerful level of being. On its own, it's a weak level of reality.
It needs something to...
Yeah. On its own, it's not a weak level of reality. On its own, it doesn't exist. It's not a weak level. And where it does exist, it's very powerful.
Because it's been given the...
Because it's Hashem's reality. You understand what I'm saying?
It takes a while to assimilate this.
Yeah. In other words, it's not on its own, it's a weak level of reality because it needs something. On its own, it's b'chlal not a reality.
Right.
It's not a weak level. And where its reality begins, it's as strong as it gets. Where its reality does begin, it's as strong as it gets. It's a, yesh mi yesh is the pshad. The yesh is there in the yesh.
It's a transformation. Yes,
it's a transformation.
It's one form,
exactly.
Another form. It's not creation.
Right? It's not creation. The first later yesh was there. It's there be'etzem. Yesh ma'ayin, it's not there. How do you come into my mind? Elam, I have a power of imagination. I could create you. That's what it is, yeah? So you have no yachas there, it's all about me. So that means, why don't you remain there? Why should you remain there? You were never there. Elamai, I could be there. So if I'm doing it, fine. If not, not.
Powerfully attractive idea.
It's a very, very powerful idea. Walter Rebbe explains according to Achdus Hashem. This is what Achdus Hashem means. Now we'll soon see that this is a lower level of Achdus Hashem.
Right. That's right.
What that's right. It's not enough. This is called Yichud Tatan. There's even a higher level of unity, a deeper level of unity, which this is what he wants to discuss here in Chaf and Chafalaf. You said another good part, that in the mashal that I gave the daydream, it's not really Yeshmiyayin because he is culling from previous data that he has stored in his mind. That's true. In that, the analogy is weak. But it is powerful in the sense that
it allows one to imagine.
It allows one to extrapolate and imagine this concept. Obviously. Obviously.
But just the semblance of the similarities enough to give us a... to our limited knowledge and comprehension of
right. Right. In other words, our imagination can't really create something from nothing. It has to use some things. But it's the closest that we get to creating something from nothing. That's the what the, Hashem doesn't have to cull from previous data to create the world. He has a resemblance of the heaven or of the planets or of the human being or of an animal. It's totally created. No. That's her Tom and Paul. Okay, good. Now, the fact that the world is Yesh Me'ayin is an axiom in Jewish philosophy. The Ramban on Bereishis Bara says Bara means Yesh Me'ayin. Many of the major Jewish philosophers discuss it at length. Yesh Me'ayin. But to develop it this way, the Alter Rebbe.
Scenarios talk about a daydream, more like, let's say, a puppet show, a puppet. In other words, let's say a child comes and sees a puppet, a king, a queen, and he sees this whole reality. And the fact of the matter is, there's some either behind it with a string, within the you know, the reality, more of a, in other words, uh-huh. The reality base. You're seeing this whole reality of a king and a queen and a whole set, the whole, whatever the whole puppet show is. But in reality, it's
strings.
Someone's pulling it really doing a certain level. You know, that's how I understand. I don't know if it's, in other words, it might not be the point of Yesh
Me'ayin, but it's the point of a constant, someone
it's
constantly.
It's a Gavra, it's really the Gavra. It's not the reality. People see the reality, the king, there's a queen. The reality is, it's that person's
right.
It's the puppeteer.
Your imagination
behind
has
it.
More right. Freedom to roam than a puppet which is attached to a string.
But the concept is, because there is reality, this is world.
Right.
I mean, there is.
Obviously,
yesh.
That's the whole
there,
Vart.
There is
a Yesh.
But, okay.
But the whole Yeshus of it. Is him making it.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. There is a puppet. The kids see a whole story. There is a king, there's a queen that can touch the puppet.
Yeah.
The reality is, it's
right.
A Gavra.
Oh, you mean versus, he says in imagination, there's no Yesh. There's no, you can't feel the person.
But a puppet will see, so a puppet may not move without the person thinking about it, but a puppet will exist without the person thinking.
Right, that's what we want to say, that it won't exist without it. The puppet, if you stop pulling it, it'll just be.
Won't exist.
The story won't exist.
The personality,
but
the people speaking and moving, and the whole story won't continue on if it's not for the energy.
Very good words, powerful words in the sheets. I think it's worth studying. There was one thing interesting when you. This analogy with the imagination.
Yeah.
I recall the metaphor for Adam. Quite interesting. That one of them. Adam Elyon, that is precisely, and Dimayon is imagination.
Very good.
Adama,
Dimyon.
It's precisely my ability to imagine is my similarity to God.
No properties that are similar. So you cannot identify creation in its most abstract form in God's reality. You see, Chassidus struggles with this a lot, because on one hand we say that the world projects godliness. Water embodies chesed. Fire embodies gvura, the spheres are the building blocks of creation, and so on and so forth. So Chassidus goes on to emphasize that it's only, it projects him, but only him as he contracted himself, which means as he allowed himself to be identified as a source of creation. There's a part of him where you cannot identify him as a source of creation in any way. And that's where there is an infinite space, so to speak, and that's where the whole creation on its first level has to be attributed solely to him, where he consciously desired to create something anew, not as a consequence, as a product, as a development, as an evolution from himself. And hence, the world really doesn't exist. If it would be anything but that, the world would exist. There wouldn't be Achdus Hashem. There's an infinite gap, a dichotomy, an infinite... And then, once he identifies in himself creation, so therefore, one of them, Kabbalim writes, Moshe Kadavir writes a fascinating thing. He says, there's a closer similarity between a physical stone and the deepest quality of Hashem's being than the similarity between the deepest quality of Hashem's being and Hashem himself. Because in the deepest quality of Hashem, he identifies himself as a source of creation. So the rock will ultimately come from there. It will take myriads of evolutionary stages, but it will come from there, because he identified himself as a source for reality, as a source for being. It's called Tzimtzum. It's a process called Tzimtzum.
Goy says I believe there's a God. What does that mean? I exist, that's for sure. And I believe that
spoke
that
last week.
God is the Chiddush. The opposite. God exists and I'm the Chiddush.
Ataza. Gut gesagt. Sei gesund.
Rabbi Jacobson delivers this weekly class on the Tanya at Heichal Menachem in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, New York. To order additional tapes or albums, please call Heichal Menachem at 718-633-1076.